All right, well, I'm really happy to be here and happy to see all of you. In my quick 12 minutes, I want to say, first of all, a few words about what this George project is. Well, first of all, George is one of those names that, like, somebody said, we need a name, and then they said, well, let's call it this because of a place we happen to be in Boston Harbor, and then they just haven't thought of a better one, but we think it's kind of, it's growing on us. And by us, I don't mean to speak of like a highly organized, tightly knit, institutionalized entity, but rather a kind of affinity group of law professors who believe that public health law is in trouble. Public health is in trouble in the law. We are losing too many legal battles and too many fundamental principles that make public health legally possible are eroding. Well, that's the sad news. We'll talk some about that, and you have some people talking to you who are really deep thinkers in that vein. I'm going to be talking more happily, as you can see from the title of my particular talk, because the other side of the coin is, I think, that we have fallen into some habits of thought about public health law that, and indeed about public health, that are not really productive to either political victory or really victory in health. And part of the George Project practice is to just ask how many things we know for sure might be wrong. And to try and think of different ways to approach problems intellectually as a way of finding new ways to approach them practically. George was first funded by my program, Public Health Law Research. That is to say, we funded a meeting, and then the Network for Public Health Law funded another meeting, and I think we're going to try and organize a symposium this year and kind of let people know that it's out there and that we'd like people to contribute there, you know, a wider group of people to contribute some ideas about how we make law work better for public health. But in the meantime, we'll sort of give you a session today that highlights some of the places we individually and collectively are at the moment. So first of all, I am at a place with no relationships to disclose, at least as defined by the APHA, and the other ones I choose not to disclose. So there are really two points here. Right. One, I just can't stress enough, because I think this is empirically true. Public health law, public health measures are popular. They are not unpopular. You may watch Fox News all you want. It does not change the world. Generally speaking, and I'll go through some measures of this popularity, what we do as public health lawyers has a lot of support in our country. And secondly, I think we talk about public health law and what we define as some of the problems of public health law in a deeply habitual and really fatuous way that doesn't help us either convince other people better about what we're doing or really help us understand what the real barriers are to changing behavior using law as the tool. So that'll be the second part of my talk. So, you know, the big claim here is people hate interfering laws. Bloomberg as nanny. It ain't so. Law is not the nanny. Law is more like, if you remember old Saturday Night Live, Stuart Smalley. You know, I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and gol darn it, people like me. First piece of evidence, which I think is absolutely the best evidence, is this figure next to it. That's a figure from an article I have coming out next January in the Annual Review of Law and Social Science. These are just adoption curves of various kinds of laws. And you can see, you know, going, you know, starting back in the 70s up till recently, and you could find many more examples, you know, by the best measure of popularity at all, enactment by legislatures. Law is an easy sell. Lots and lots of public health laws are being passed all the time and are spreading rapidly across the country and being implemented. Right down to now concussion law, for example. Youth sport concussion law just... all states have it now. You know, 5 years, 4 years ago, really no states had it. And that's not atypical. That's kind of common. Michelle Mello and Stephanie Moraine did a nice article that came out in Health Affairs this year that found similar results. It's a pretty sophisticated analysis they do using sort of procedural justice and legitimacy kind of analysis. But, you know, as you go down the list, for the most part, no matter how you ask the question, people are generally in favor of taking action against problems. Now, there's some important qualifications in all this, which I will get to. But my point is that we have evidence here, too, that even in terms of attitudes, people want public health to take action, and they see law as a generally good way for action to be taken. And time is on our side. There's another paper that I think Michelle is going to work on, I think with some people from my group, which is basically to capture the fact, in terms of looking at polling, that if you focus on what people say when you introduce the regulation, you may, and especially if you focus on what sort of gets reported in the in the press and sort of the story of the battle, it's a very different picture than if you wait 6 months. How many people are getting up in the morning and saying, "God damn government, make me wear a seatbelt, make me put my child in a child restraint seat. Got rid of those smoke-filled rooms." No, I mean, norms change, habits change, and we find that measures that were once controversial or disputed are become accepted. And indeed, people would get angry if you try to, take it away. "Keep the government's hands off my Medicare," you might say. Sorry for the pun, the nanny was reelected twice. Now that's not, I can't say this is the highest standard of evidence. This is not randomized control trials. It's sort of observational, but it's purely my own observation. But, we're working to kind of fill in this story empirically. And I think it's, so far I don't see big problems with it. And of course, the most important thing is it works. CDC's list of 10 great public health achievements of the last century nearly all depend to a greater or lesser degree on law. And in fact, what we really need to be, saying all the time to people in public health practice and to policymakers is, you really can't do public health in the modern world without law. And nobody tries to who has any degree of success. And it would be silly to try to do so because you need law almost everywhere. We still talk about, these tropes that just come to our minds. Americans just hate paternalism. There's this tension with civil liberties sort of inherent in public. The first paragraph of the article or the first paragraph of the book. Lindsay's editing Larry's book, so I'm sure that's not going to be there in the first page in the next edition. We can't touch it. It's the third rail. CDC and local agencies terrified of getting involved in politics or policy. As my old father would have said, enough already with this. First of all, clearly Sunstein and Thaler are empirically correct. The whole behavioral economics is empirically correct. Preferences are really soft and malleable most of the time. Not always, but a lot of the time. And so you will see that effect over time, that something that strikes people intuitively initially as bad becomes acceptable and then even embraced. I think another important thing to get out of the polling data is people like their government parent under certain conditions, right? Not blindly, not stupidly, not necessarily excessively beyond, people have a kind of sense of reasonableness, but if they feel that the rule is fair and it deals with a real risk and it deals with it in a sensible way, as that is understood popularly, not necessarily epidemiologically or physiologically, then generally speaking, you get support and you get those adoption curves where all the people, all the legislators, left and right, R&D support passage. Of course, the other thing to remember is that a lot of this opposition that is framed in terms of rights and paternalism is typically coming from regulated industries. Which is fine. That's what regulated industries do when you try and regulate them. But we just have to keep in mind that that's not a popular uprising. This is AstroTurf, not grassroots. Moreover, as we shall see, I'm not minimizing that, because there are a lot of very strong rights in this country today, individual rights, and the individuals that have them are are corporate entities. The rest of us, not so much. But if you are a corporation, you are a serious rights bearer. And so that's an important qualification. Now, see, there's one other point I wanted to get. Yeah, and finally, you know, remember when we think about this, policy is dangerous for health agencies to get mixed up in. You know, that comes with a huge asterisk, which is it's dangerous if it happens to be a policy that a regulated industry is going to oppose. But if it isn't in that area, quite often there's no disagreement at all. And agencies that don't take policy action are likely to get criticized rather than protected. And that's even true within CDC. You know, there are whole branches that haven't been told that, you know, policy is dangerous. Because in their particular area, people are reasonably happy with policy. So all those are canards, and we should stop repeating them. Because we have to, you know, find new things to say. Most importantly, we have to, I think, avoid fooling ourselves. Right? Because as long as we keep defining our business as somehow avoiding paternalism or softening it or avoiding tensions between civil rights and public health, we miss what I think are some of the harder challenges, and these are a few of them. I mean, one is that we're just really good at stopping people from crashing into walls without seatbelts and airbags. But it's harder as you go upstream. You know, when you're not stopping a kid from overdosing or dying of an overdose or stopping a kid from getting a concussion right there, people are very available to people, they can imagine it, but that's all at the very end of the kinds of causal chains that we in public health would really like to change at the other end. And that's much harder. And figuring out how we take, you know, upstream prevention and make it seem as salient and make it seem as fair and make it seem as sensible is a huge challenge that I think we are not dealing with all that well. And obesity is a perfect example, right? Because, you know, we're kind of saying, you know, if you eat a lot, you know, you probably get, you know, over time you're going to put on weight. And some people who put on weight, you know, they're more likely to get diabetes. That's true. You know, a long time in the future. Of course, some of them will actually live longer than their thin friends. But still, a lot of them are going to, you know, it's really bad, right? And the harm is weighing the same as everybody you know. It's a harder sell. I'm not saying it's wrong. It's just a much harder sell. And, you know, a lot of times what we tell people is we know better because we've got epidemiology and we figured this out. Our prediction is better than your prediction because we're irrational. That's not a big seller. We use the language of science oftentimes, and this is where, you know, paternalism is interesting to think about, or other things, as an example of using the language of values or principles. We tend in public health to be very consequentialist. And so we miss a chance to use other kinds of argumentation, which after all comes down to the question, especially when you're getting to your marginal goals, you know, the last smoker in the last private apartment in the last, you know, house on the block. Yeah, it'd be nice if they didn't smoke in that building. You know, is public health the highest value? It's nice if you put a motorcycle helmet on. Is, you know, who's to say that the wind blowing through your hair is not more important than the blood streaming out of your broken skull? That's, you know, to some degree is a choice someone can make. I don't have a lot of time to go into this, but I highly recommend that people look at Jonathan Haidt's work. He's an evolutionary psychologist to try to understand our moral intuitions, and this very, very much follows along the behavioral economics and the stuff from, you know, that side of the coin. But basically what he has here in his research is tried to identify these six basic flavors of moral intuition and rapid reaction. You know, that notion of caring for others, preventing harm, the opposition of liberty, you know, versus oppression, fairness as opposed to cheating, loyalty as opposed to behavior, authority opposed to subversion, sanctity opposed to segregation. He's got a lot of evidence of how these exist sort of across cultures. But what you see with those bars is the typical liberal person who takes one of their screens ends up being very strong on preventing harm, preventing oppression, and ensuring fairness, and kind of weak on everything else, whereas conservatives, social conservatives, pretty much, they have all those taste buds. It's not that they don't care about harm, but they also care about sanctity, for example. So, you know, they might not want to see a drug user die without a needle, but they're really concerned that giving somebody a needle and encouraging drug use is kind of an unholy behavior, right? Well, guess which one public health typically looks like, right? I mean, public health, all we ever talk about is we're going to prevent harm. You know, we're going to stop disparities. It's fairness and harm prevention. And it's not that those are wrong. It's just that people don't respond to those the way we do. everybody. And we've got to find ways to talk to people who have different moral majesties, because they're not unconcerned about public health. They're not unconcerned about fairness. They're not unconcerned about justice. They care about other things too. They're balancing things differently. Right? And it's time to stop dismissing them as people who don't understand that, you know, we descended from monkeys, and rather understand people making perhaps their own difficult moral calculations who deserve engagement and respect, and who we can win over if we can do it right. So, and then finally, of course, we just can expect to lose some. Like, sometimes your water, you know, the town just doesn't want to have fluoride in the water, and sometimes person doesn't want to have a motorcycle helmet on, and it's not the end of the world. We got plenty of battles that we can fight. We might choose them a little better, politically speaking. So how do we, it's really about changing the game, right? I mean, right now, we sort of face this accepted social reality. Government can't get it right, so taxes are a waste. Why pay them if they're not outright theft? Markets can't get it wrong, or anyway, we can't do any better. You know, face it, then we're all on our own in this society. Now, don't let any recent website events convince you that this is correct. We have to, in spite of the difficulty and occasional lapses, resell the idea that we need our government. It can get it right. It must get it right. Right? We should be no more tolerant of bad governance than the people who don't like government. If you like government, you should be even more intolerant of bad government. You should be even more critical. Right? Because we need government to work. That's our belief. And therefore, we're happy to pay our taxes because we get what we paid for. Obviously, the rest are pretty clear. Most importantly, we're all in this together. This is one way to think about it and one way to reframe it, but the point is we have a lot of reframing and rethinking to do, and the stuff we've been saying over and over and over again since Lemuel Shattuck, if not before, it just has limited punch. We have to try something new. So stop apologizing. And realize there really is, on the internet, a don't tread on me mixed with a Caduceus. Very easy to find. So if somebody else has thought of this, it's viral. Let's be tough and stop apologizing and start changing minds more effectively than we have. So thanks very much. I have to run to teach a class in a couple of minutes, so I'm not storming out in disgust at my own presentation. thank you very much.